Greetings, dear listeners. It's Shadi and Santiago this week with a very special guest I'll let them introduce. I'll just say that he's the author of a recent well-reviewed novel about meaning, finding one's calling, love, and asking all the right questions about life. In short, all the themes that we often argue about here on Wisdom of Crowds. It's an enchanting, long listen, a very special episode we're very proud of. I'm sure you'll all enjoy it. Before we get started, a reminder to head on over to wisdomofcrowds.live and consider becoming a paying subscriber, if you're not one yet. And don't forget to give us a like and review on your favorite podcast app. With all that out of the way, on to the show.
And I know that you're not used to being in political podcasts. This is a DC political podcast. We're starting off with who do you think Trump should pick as his VP?
Tucker Carlson.
that would be pretty compelling.
The other day I tweeted, I may have deleted it, but I was wondering if, Tucker's like a big promoter of Zen, and it's actually today's day two of me, being off the Zyn, or maybe day three.
What's Zyn?
What is Zyn?
It's like a nicotine pouch thing. Mm. But like, I noticed that the 3 milligram Zyn is the same price as the 6 milligram Zyn, which doesn't make any sense to me. It should be half the price, I feel like, because it's half the product. And I suggested that Tucker Carlson run as Trump's VP so that he could get that sorted.
That's a top priority.
I feel like a lot of people would appreciate that.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted I don't know.
Besides that, I don't have any.
The other thing I wanted to start off with is yesterday you tweeted, or 2 days ago, I can't remember. A quote from Harold Bloom trashing James Wood. So literary critics going out, and you were like, critics and writers don't talk like this anymore. And then everyone was like, have you read Becca Rothfeld's review in Washington Post? But what I want to talk about is which writer would you like to trash? Don DeLillo, Jonathan Franzen?
Well, maybe we can save that for later. That's probably like a little bit too specialized to start because a lot
that's
of people
bonus,
don't.
That's bonus material.
Yeah, that's bonus material.
Yeah,
you don't
trash the writers in the paywalled part.
Exactly.
And it's hard, it's hard because it's like, if you trash a writer like DeLillo or Franzen, it's hard not to just sound like resentful of their success. It's so easy to sort of just point at like the very successful writers and say like, they suck or whatever. I also haven't read Franzen, so
hasn't stopped people before.
It's true. It actually didn't stop Harold Bloom from trashing James Wood. He was like, I've never read the guy, he doesn't exist.
Harold Bloom reads a book an hour.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's what he claims. At least he's a
red. I mean, he's dead now, so he really doesn't exist.
He exists in the afterlife, though, probably.
Yeah,
it's possible. Yeah.
I think this is the first podcast in a while where all three people on it believe in the afterlife.
Mm. Wow.
So,
well, we can probably unpack that too.
Yeah. So, yeah, lots of material here. But yeah, just so people that are joining us, this voice is not familiar to you, perhaps. I am Santiago. I am the executive editor of Wisdom of Crowds. I am guest hosting here with Shadi Hamid and a very special guest, the novelist Jordan Castro, who has written a book called The Novelist, which I think we can call it a success, right? It's been reviewed. It has a sort of what do you call it? Followers?
Cult following,
yeah. And I think it's a very interesting book. As soon as I started reading it, I knew I wanted to get him on the pod, in part to ask him questions about the culture you know, the culture, but also just to like get a, to know the guy.
You say culture, a demon, and the culture. Yeah,
And Shadi also, I think you enjoyed the book as well, didn't you, Shadi?
Don't put words in my mouth, man. No, I mean, all jokes aside, well, first of all, I should note this is the first time we've had a full-time, we've had a part-time novelist on before, Tara Isabella Burton. She also writes nonfiction. This is the first time that we've like gone all out in this direction of someone who is like fully part of the literary scene in that way. And apparently that's what he does for a living. I guess he is a novelist, so by definition. But yeah, so it's really exciting for that reason. And I absolutely love, okay, I'm not even just saying this because you're on, Jordan. I loved the book. I laughed so much. I thought it was hilarious. I honestly couldn't, I haven't felt this much just sheer enjoyment, pleasure, wow, like reading a book in a long time. Because oftentimes you'll read something and it's almost like you're doing work. You're reading books because you think you should read them or because other novelists are saying, oh, this is the new author to read and all of that. This was just like pleasure. Wow. I didn't have to like, not that it's not intellectually engaging, but I didn't feel like I had to like overwork my like mind too much. And I could just like be in the moment and let it and just savor it and let it simmer. So you've done something, I think, I mean, not everyone likes it. I mean, it's a polarizing book based on the reviews that I've seen in Goodreads. Some people did not like it. I don't know what they're thinking, but we can get into that, like why or how the book was polarizing. But that's, yeah, anyway. So
I appreciate it. I mean, I feel like that's some of the highest, I mean, one of the, I'm always conscious of wanting to like write something that's actually fun to read, nice to read. You know what I mean? Some of my favorite novels are just, you know, whatever other good qualities they have, like the fact of being able to sit down with something and enjoy reading it is like, is great. So I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah. People don't focus on that as much. I feel like, you know, yeah, the enjoyment of the reader isn't always like necessarily emphasized. And I think we might also have a similar sense of humor. Like I felt in reading it that you're someone that I could be friends with. Like, oh, I could just hang out with this guy. And it's got like a kind of raunchy element to it. And we can maybe get into that. Like, there's a lot of reference to poo, P-O-O. Like, it's very, I saw one of the reviews of your book. It described it as exuberantly scatological.
Yeah.
Scatological just means, I think, referring to human. We don't want to put people off. Like my mom may not like, but like there's references to the toilet, to things yeah. like that. And it's very real in that sense, because that's an important part of our lives. We go to the toilet. One has to defecate in order to survive, but it's something that is not really honored in fiction and literature. When you think about like Tolstoy, you don't necessarily think defecation. So I like that you're trying to like bring this back in, because it is part of who we are. So kudos for that.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah. It's actually a very interesting contrast, because on the one hand, your character seems to live online in this sort of like bodiless existence. But on the other hand, he has to go and do his business, and you describe it with great accuracy. But maybe by the way, we should say a few things about the book so that our listeners that
first
haven't
you
read
it
can follow. First of all,
we'll
buy
include a link to it in the show notes. Like honestly, like if get it from your library, you don't even have to like buy it necessarily. In fact, Jordan is literally recording this episode right now from his local library. So we also want to encourage people to remember that libraries exist. But yeah,
kind of. But we also want to encourage them to buy it. You know?
Yeah, of course, of course.
So I think the novel is called The Novelist, and it has to do with a few hours in the day of an unnamed character who is writing a novel, who's just woken up. His wife is still in bed. he's making tea. I think later he makes coffee and he's trying to follow, he's trying to write his novel on Google Docs, but he keeps instinctively, he's hooked on Twitter and Instagram. And I don't know if he checks, I think he checks Facebook once. and if I describe it like this, it sounds like a boring novel, like 200 pages about 5 or 6 hours in a guy's life. But as Shadi said, it's hilarious. And I think it's very profound. And dare I say existential, whatever that might mean. But when I think The Stranger, Camus, The Moviegoer, Walker Percy, The Novelist, Jordan Castro, because they all have to do with self, self-examination in a, during the midlife crisis of the main character.
There's a lot of self-loathing, which I appreciate. That really resonates.
Mm.
So do you think I did justice to your book?
I like how you just compared him to Camus, one of the great authors of the 20th century. That is high praise.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I did a, you know, I did an interview like I don't know, maybe a year or so ago, and I was like, sort of responding, saying like, you know, yeah, I think I'm sort of like working in the tradition of Dostoevsky, and then I emailed him afterward, and I was like, can you actually change it to just saying I am Dostoevsky? I was thinking of that, you know, when Kanye, there's that classic clip of Kanye where he's like, I'm Steve Jobs, I'm Walt Disney, you know. And so he changed it, you know, and I do unironically view myself as sort of working in that tradition. So so I'm the new Dostoevsky, you know. Camus, yeah. I mean, The Stranger actually, weirdly enough, was like one of the first novels that I read in like ninth grade, and I think most of it went over my head. And I remember my English teacher at the time sort of seeing that I was reading it and walking past me and being like, "Oh, The Stranger," and then she said something about the metaphor of the sun or something like that, or the symbolism of the heat and the sun. And I had no idea what she was talking about. And I was like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I pretended to know what she was talking about, but I had no idea.
Yeah. But you know, the first thing I wanted to ask you is, though, where do you come from as a writer? So it's it's almost like a cliche now to talk about autofiction as a genre that is popular, you know, especially in New York. And actually, the first time I heard from you was about you was from John Baskin, editor of The Point. And he told me he was going to a reading in New York where people are reading their stories about themselves out of fiction. And I asked him, why do you like that? And he said, because people are using fiction to work through their lives, to work through what's happening, he thinks. And I think it's like a post-COVID development, he said. It's less about politics, more about art. And then I asked him, who is maybe the best writer to come out of this movement? And he said, Jordan Castro. So, oh, wow. And so I got your book. So what is out of fiction for our listeners? And why do you think people are into it now?
Yeah. First of all, shouts out John Baskin. But second of all, yeah, I mean, I autofiction is one of these weird terms that gets used a lot and to mean like a sort of a lot of different things. I think, you know, a lot of people sort of use it to describe sort of like autobiographical fiction, you know, where it's like if something in the novel has to do with the author's life is somewhat autobiographical, to say like, you know, this is autofiction or something like that. But there's also Christian Lorentzen, the critic, makes a distinction between sort of like autobiographical fiction, metafiction, which is, you know, sort of like fiction that references the writing of the book or whatever, and autofiction, which he says is like where the author sort of makes an appearance as a protagonist or narrator, and the writing of the novel is kind of like inscribed within the novel itself or whatever. I think it's something like that. And I've never really understood, I mean, maybe this is just sort of like typical of people who get called a certain thing, but I've never really too closely like identified with it, or not, I shouldn't say never. I mean, I should say that when I was younger, I would write a lot about my own life. You know, I've been writing and publishing since I was like 16. And I think when I was younger, I had this idea that by writing about my own life, I could sort of come to understand it or that like, you know, the process of writing about myself would sort of reveal something, and that this would have some sort of like positive effect in my life. And I've sort of soured on that idea. I kind of think that's just not true. That's just not the case. It hasn't been the case with me. And so Dean Kissick, the writer called The Novelist, meta anti autofiction, you know, where on the one hand it's sort of autofictive, like there are certain details in the novel that are true of my life or whatever. But on the other hand, I sort of wanted it to be like a criticism of autofiction as well, which is, you know, that like sort of just by this, having this sort of like almost myopic kind of like self-centered, you know, just sort of always turning in and thinking about oneself and one's own thoughts and stuff, that this actually doesn't necessarily lead. I mean, in the novel, the narrator doesn't really end up writing, you know, I mean, he kind of ends up writing and stuff like that, but he sort of fails at his main task, you know? And I think like there's something not quite right about the idea that like, you can just kind of like interpret your own experience through thinking about your own experience or something like that.
More about that last part. There's a problem in sort of, I guess, navel gazing, but obviously in a culture where we're always like therapizing and pathologizing, and we're always trying to find ourselves and looking inward and doing the work. And there's like this perpetual quest to make ourselves into a project. And this is a theme that we've looked at in recent episodes. Like we are startups for ourselves, and like we're the CEOs of our own lives, and we're always, you know, we're trying to make ourselves better. And part of that is this constant, you know, reassessment, self-assessment, and so forth. And I think that, you know, there's a danger in doing too much of that. There's something to be said for being in the world and just like living without always like reflecting it back onto yourself.
Yeah. Kierkegaard in the novel, there's a passage about Kierkegaard. The first thing that he published, I think, was a review of some Hans Christian Andersen novels. And what he says is that Hans Christian Andersen's novels don't have a life view. And so he says, like, there's a difference between asking the question, like, is life really meaningful? Which can sort of like spread out endlessly and kind of just meander into like these sort of like fragmented, like poetic moods or something, which I think is what a lot of autofiction does. It's sort of this like meandering, these like tones or these moods or something like that. And so he says there's a difference between asking, is life really meaningful, versus like, how can I live a meaningful life, which is sort of more active, kind of has certain presuppositions sort of built into it, you know? And I think that, there's this way of kind of endlessly looking inward or endlessly asking questions and endlessly kind of like, you know, analyzing oneself that actually doesn't lend itself to like any sort of insight or knowledge. It's sort of an excuse to just like kind of stay stuck or scattered or like noncommittal or something like that. And there's this way of approaching literature now that's very fashionable, you know, which is to say that like, you know, it's just basically to frame it in these therapeutic terms. You know, I wrote this because I had to, you know, I wrote this because like, you know, I needed to sort of like find something out about myself, you know, or make myself whole or something like that. And for me, that's just, it's never worked, you know, it's also just not the point of literature, you know?
What is the point of literature in your view?
Oh God.
you got yourself into that one.
Yeah. I mean, I think that literature is sort of fundamentally an aesthetic project. You know what I mean? It's to sort of like, Nicholson Baker says the point of literature is to delight and instruct, which is something that I've been sort of thinking about more and more. But at risk of sort of biting off more than I can chew, I should say that I feel like I can at least say that the function of literature is not to is not therapy. But you know, but I, you know, I guess that's a start.
Would you go as far as Flaubert, how he defined literature?
How does he how does he define literature?
A perpetual orgy.
I didn't see that coming.
There's a book by Mario Vargas Llosa called The Perpetual Orgy, a study of Flaubert's Madame Bovary. So that's a that's a pretty precise definition, very well detailed.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe in practice, you know? I don't know. It's hard to say.
Actually, to follow up on what Shadi's saying, because you did say something very, very like meaningful about life. You said there's a difference between asking, is life meaningful in a sort of abstract way, versus saying, how can I live a meaningful life? Which I guess is implies that you're going to act, right? So then in your book, in the same passage where you were just talking about, you say, asking the wrong questions would result in a disjointed, world-weary meandering. The wrong questions made novels that bled out into life and lives that bled into novels. Everything a lukewarm soup of fragmented poetic moods. The wrong questions consumed rather than gave. So what are the right questions that motivate your life and a good novel?
I answered this question. I was trying to remember. I answered this question before in a way that that felt satisfying. You know, I think that I've been thinking lately that sometimes it seems like a lot of novels that I like, I'll say, like maybe like Crime and Punishment or something like that, or Notes from Underground, seem to start with like a premise that they're sort of like sort of working out. You know, like maybe Crime and Punishment is sort of like this, this kind of like investigation is sort of like a hackneyed word at this point, but you know, it's sort of like, it's like, it starts with this idea, you know, like, you know, is man the sort of like master of his own destiny? You know, is there a sort of moral law inscribed in the universe? And if not, you know, can one just sort of like take it upon oneself to sort of like, you know, become the sort of Ubermenschen figure or whatever, you know, sort of like this, you can start with a sort of premise and sort of work it out or whatever, which I think leads to different and more specific kinds of results than just meandering. It's hard to say. And the other thing that's strange is that I think part of writing is that it sort of like emerges like semi-consciously or something like that. And, you know, I'm always sort of like trying to like interpret what I've done or see what I've done. And so it's like, yeah, it's hard to say. I'm not sure.
I mean, with this book, did you have a clear sense of where you were going, or it was kind of unformed and you just sat down and it was almost like, cause the book sort of feels sometimes like a dream. There's something, it's like, and I assume that writing a book like this that doesn't have a clear plot, it's just about a day or half a day in the life, is different than your kind of traditional novel where you have characters, a plot, and an arc and a resolution. So I'm curious, like, how did you actually write this, and how clear were you about your intent before you started?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the novel started with, one, I mean, I guess this is the autofiction part of it, is like, I was waking up every morning trying to work on this novel that wasn't going anywhere. And so a part of me was just wanting to see and just observe what was happening when I would get distracted, as I was trying to write, you know, because I would wake up in the morning with this, you know, full of intention and hope to write. And then, you know, the next thing I knew, I'm like on Twitter and 5 minutes disappear. And then I'm like, you know, checking my email and refreshing it over and over again. And it seems like it's happening in this sort of like unconscious, almost like possessed kind of way. And I was like, I wonder what would happen if I just sort of like almost in like a mindfulness exercise or something, tried to like really pay attention to like the mechanics of what was happening, like when I was getting distracted, and just see what's actually going on, like sort of observe, trying to like observe myself or something like that. And so I just started writing kind of like about that, you know, just to sort of like see what was going on. But also at the same time, I had this like falling out with one of my friends, now ex-friends, who sort of appears in the novel as this character.
Eric.
Yeah. Who kind of like had become sort of possessed by the kind of like, you know, ideology of the day or whatever. And I was just like writing these sort of like rants about him and feeling very sort of self-satisfied, self-righteous, you know, about like sort of poning my friend. And I had also read this novel called Woodcutters by Thomas Bernhard, where it's just sort of like the narrator sitting at this dinner party, kind of like chimping out about how much he hated all of the guests. And I was like, wait a second, I could actually like, you know, incorporate this into some sort of literary work. And so the novel kind of emerged like of me kind of like constructing a narrative around like both of these things. You know, at first I think it was
literally what you just talked about happening to you in real life is what happens to the character in the book.
Right, I know, which is why, I mean, I think as much as
I can't even keep track of reality and fiction here because
I know. As much as I like to say, you know, it's a book of anti-autofiction, it's criticizing autofiction. I kind of can't escape the fact.
So what do you get? Why was it cathartic? Like when I read this, I was like, this is cool because it's a rebellion against social media and tech and all the culture that constantly just distracts us. You're sort of reclaiming yourself.
Yeah, I mean, what was I think cathartic about it was partly that I was sort of like transfiguring my like tortured, distracted experience into something that could be like used for art or whatever. You know, and now that I'm not doing that, you know, I have another novel coming out that has nothing to do with the internet. The distraction has been much less you know, generative. You know, now it's just like, oh man, it's bleak again. You know what I mean? Just getting distracted constantly. But for a while, it felt very, very productive because then I would get distracted, and then I would sort of like, yeah, use it toward some sort of artistic end. Mm. But
that means that you're sort of leaving out of fiction, which is something that Shadi is sad about.
You're leaving?
Yeah.
Oh, Shadi just got started.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. It's weird. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of the reason why, I mean, I think, you know, part of the thing that's strange about autofiction, or at least, you know, I grew up online, and I think part of it is like, you know, I've always had the experience ever since I was like 16 or 15 of kind of like interpreting my own life or experience, like filtering it through this lens of like something that could be made for content or something that could be used for literature or whatever. And so in some ways, I'm just like, I've just been like unable to escape that sort of zone that I kind of like, you know, I became sort of like self-aware, like online, you know, which is always kind of navigating the space between like my own self-awareness, awareness of the other, you know, what is kind of like my own thoughts and what is like being sort of like, filtered through this lens of like, you know, the awareness that it could be turned into something that could be like funny or entertaining for other people. And so, in some ways I just can't escape it. I don't know. Or haven't been able to.
Huh. And I want to just dwell on Eric for a second, the guy that you end up hating, or the narrator ends up hating in the book and going on these rants, which are like very amusing. Apparently, yeah. So I guess Eric is, you know, as you just said, a real person. Does the equivalent in real life, has that person read your book and knows that Eric is based off of him? Like, do you have to be careful when you're drawing on your own experiences that people in your circle, your social circle, will be like, oh, that's me? And you have to be careful to like have some plausible deniability, because it's really mean what you, I mean, it seems like he deserves it. He seems like a genuinely like bad person, Eric. But it must be hard if you're reading like a book and you just want to have a good time and just relax with it. And then you're like, oh my God, the novelist who I'm reading, he's talking about, like, that must like really hurt, you know?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I used to, when I was younger, be like, whatever, all is fair. And in our, you know, it's fiction. And so, you know, it might be like, you know, rooted in these real people in life, but it's fiction, right? Like, I'm making choices as I'm writing that like are ultimately like aesthetic and literary choices. And so, like, you know, it's not exactly like how I, Jordan, feel, you know? But at the same time, I didn't think about that because like the narrator is very like sort of cruel to this guy who in real life, you know, I mean, I obviously find, I mean, he's basically kind of like the, all the worst aspects of kind of like a sort of like white guy, sort of like punishing progressive, sort of like fool or whatever.
But you call him a nihilist. So yeah, well, I was like, what is he? I was asking myself, I was like, what is this guy? What does Eric represent?
Well,
what worldview? Or just what?
I mean, to answer the first question, I mean, first of all, I think he probably does know that it's him, and actually read Eric in the novel is sort of a composite character between these two people. And I was asked to do a reading with one of them. and I, after the novelist came out and I did it, and the guy who Eric is mainly based on showed up, and didn't say anything to me and then left right after, but he showed up with like a crew and I was like a little bit nervous. So I like read from the novelist with this guy in the audience. But then afterwards, one of the guys who Eric's based on, we sort of had this nice heart to heart where he, like apologized for being like really cruel on Twitter, and all this stuff, in front of other people too. And it was kind of this weird, and I forgave him and I also apologized for, for my role in certain things. And it was kind of this beautiful thing. And afterward, my friends were like, why did you apologize to that guy? He's such an asshole and da, da, da. Or, you know, why did you, you know, sort of make up with him? And it was kind of this beautiful thing. I mean, we're still not friends or whatever, but it was kind of nice. You know?
Wow.
You know, because I think part of it is that like, you know, with, at least as I was writing the novel, yeah, he's spazzing on this guy. It's this full rant section. But I realized that some of that, even as much as I find the kind of like, you know, sort of contemporary strain of sort of like what I view of it is a sort of like life hating, sort of like nihilistic, sort of materialist, sort of like crudely, I don't want to say like progress, you know, this sort of like woke is a terrible word for it, you know, but something approximating that, you know, as much as I find that completely repugnant and delusional, and idiotic, whenever I find myself seething about it, it's usually like cope for something else that's going on, right? Like this narrator has been trying and failing to write a novel all morning. And then he finally finds his expression in just spazzing about some guy who's like not in the room with him, just tweeted something or whatever. And so like, you know, there's a way to use this kind of like that one can use a sort of like self-righteous mode, even if you're like right, quote unquote, about everything, in order to like scapegoat someone that's not even there and has nothing to do with anything, as a way of like making yourself feel better about your own failings. And so I think it's like, and so when I realized that was what was going on in myself and also in the character, it felt somehow clearer. I don't know.
Yeah. But it's like resentment is creative all of a sudden. Like the guy's floating around, then he's like, Eric. Then all of a sudden the words start flowing.
Right, exactly. You know, but also, you know, I mean, it's not, at least in the novel, right? I mean, the stuff that he's writing isn't actually like that all that good of like writing. I think part of what elevated the novel to like literature or something was for me that realization that there was another layer going on. You know, René Girard talks about novelists having like a novelistic conversion where like, you know, one sets out to sort of like with this hero or this villain or this idea that they want to either tear down or lift up or whatever. And Girard says that the great novelists don't become great until they're able to describe the evil of the other from within themselves. So instead of like just sort of scapegoating something or someone, they're able to kind of like recognize that within themselves and realize that the first draft is a sort of like put up job. Or something like that. And that really did happen for me, where it was like for a couple of years, I really was like, I'm just going to like, you know, write this novel where like, I'm going to prove everyone wrong and I'm going to, you know, whatever. And the sort of like humbling process of realizing actually a lot of what I've written was just totally ugly and sort of unfair and motivated by a sort of like vengeful spirit, or at least a desire to sort of like not look at my own faults or whatever. I think that really broke it open for me in some ways. It sort of made it three-dimensional.
You know, and there's one thing that comes across in your book a number of times that I found really interesting. I mean, it's sort of the cliche about writers and novelists, especially in like New York, that, you know, you seem to not have a very positive view of that scene. There's a lot of like self-important, narcissistic, indulgent writers who are just not creative. They're kind of operating in a very constrained mode. They're writing the kinds of novels that they think other people want them to write. And I'm, you know, and you talked just now about how you felt that you wanted to prove people wrong, that there was a resentment that you had, vengeance, whatever it might be. I mean, I suppose one could say that all writers are in some sense narcissists, to actually think that what you have to say to the world is so important to make it your job to tell them like your thoughts and your insights. That requires a certain kind of personality. And it's kind of like when you actually think about it that way, there's almost like an absurdity to it. Like, and you know, I don't write fiction, but but I'm a writer. And there is like, you have to think that what you have to say is important. But I think in the New York scene, as far as I can tell, based on your description, this is again, what we hear in the kind of cliched sense, these are people who are also like social climbers. Like everything is about status and everything is about being in the scene and showing other people that you're in the scene. And this is where Gerard becomes, I think, relevant. And for those, for listeners who don't know René Girard, the great French philosopher who has this idea of mimetic theory, that which is basically, to kind of boil it down, we want the things we want and desire, not because of any kind of innate sense, but because we see what other people want, and then we just kind of decide to want things based on that. It's all about reflecting our wants through other people and through society. So I'm just, maybe say a little bit more about like, do writers, like, is there something wrong with writers as a genre of people? Like, is there something wrong with us?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, you know, I mean, of course, I mean, but I'm not sure that it's any more or any less, you know, than other things. I mean, maybe a little bit more. I mean, it's something that I struggle with, you know, in myself. I mean, part of the reason why, you know, I think I wrote a novel that's kind of like poking at writers and not like dentists, is because I'm a writer, you know what I mean? And so like these, you know, I'm like, you know, and I can never tell if like, you know, what I'm doing is sort of like accurately perceiving these, like these sort of like tortured scene dynamics and stuff, you know, in others and in myself, I'm sort of like, or if I'm just kind of trying to like differentiate myself by saying that I'm, you know, that I somehow am different, you know? And I think like the tension is in sort of like, recognizing that, like, you know, it's actually difficult, yeah, not to get swooped up in these sorts of scene dynamics. I mean, I try and do things like, you know, I live, you know, I don't live in the city. I try not to sort of like, you know, I try and do what I can to kind of insulate myself from those dynamics, but it's very difficult not to. And as far as like, you know, the kind of like all writers being narcissists or whatever, like, It's weird because I think when I was younger, I think that was definitely a huge part of why I got into writing, you know, was kind of this narcissistic, kind of pompous, sort of like self-centered attitude.
And you were a narcissist when you were younger?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, and that's not to say that I'm not now, but I really do try and think about it in terms of like being in service to either the work or sort of like literature with a capital L, sort of trying to like, sort of like, yes, yeah, submit myself to some sort of like process or lineage or art form or something.
Yeah. Like I had a friend, who studied jazz in college, and he said, my job is just to keep it going.
Hmm. Hmm. Young Thug has this that song where he's like, hustlers don't stop, they keep going. You know what I'm talking about? You can lose your life, but it's gonna keep going, or whatever. You know, and it is sort of like also true of literature. You know, it's in some ways it's this hilarious thing where it's like it is something that's just so much greater than.
I think like vanity enters when you're trying to write a novel. You're trying to stand out as an individual. When you're playing jazz in an ensemble, you just want to play. And it's harder to put yourself in the mentality of the jazz player when you're trying to be a novelist, maybe. And like then throw in the whole thing about wanting to be the voice of your generation, which anyone that wants to be that will inevitably not be that.
Wait, does Jordan want to be the voice of his generation?
You know, it's, you know, at this point, it's not a matter of what I want. I just am, you know?
It's not
a matter of my wanting or not wanting it. It's just a fact at this point. So
I mean, he did reflect a lot of my interior experience in that novel. What about you, Shadi?
No, it did really resonate. I want to share one selection from the book that I just like love the way that this is written. And it's also, I think, gets at a lot of these questions of how like wanting and not wanting and the kind of mimetic aspect of this. But what's also really funny about this quote here that I'm about to share is that Jordan Castro is a character in the novel.
which confuses everything even more. But.
Which I just absolutely loved because the narrator in the novel is obsessed with Jordan Castro. And he's going on Twitter to see what Jordan Castro is tweeting. And Jordan Castro is this figure that like weighs over everything. And he sort of compares, like, how does he relate to this great Jordan Castro character? So it's really funny that you make yourself into this character. And I'd be curious if you have any thoughts on that, but basically, so here's the couple lines I wanted to share. Quote, I'm not sure. Jordan Castro, the character, is actually saying this. So I guess the narrator is watching a clip and Jordan Castro is like a bobblehead in this like viral video. And this is what I guess Jordan Castro is saying. People mistake how they think they should think for how they actually think, and how they want to seem for how they are. People mistake how they think they should think for how they actually think, and how they want to seem for how they are. I like that a lot. And because I think that it is the question for our generation. That's why I wanted to raise it in the context of Santi's question. Like, you know, did it resonate with me? I think a lot of us are struggling, like sort of perpetually in maybe a self-indulgent way of like, how do we know what we want? And is what we want what we actually want? And listeners will know, and readers, that we had a great essay from the philosopher Oliver Traldy, where he really explores this, I think, in a very powerful fashion, drawing on his own experiences over the last few years of his life. And how a lot of people say that we want too many things and we're sort of stretched too thin in that respect. But what Oliver is saying is part of the problem is maybe we don't desire enough. It's not that we don't know what we want. It's that we don't feel strongly enough about certain things to actually like emanate clear desires to ourselves. So we're always in this kind of in-between space of not being able to commit to a certain path, because sometimes we just want to like sit back and lay on the couch and just like we don't actually feel enough in some ways. So I think that your character, the narrator, like captures some of this. Like he doesn't know how to live because I don't know. I don't want to also like inscribe motivations onto the character that maybe aren't there. And maybe I'm reading too much into this, but feel free to take that where you will, Jordan, if any of that makes sense to you.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense to me. I mean, yeah, I mean, it reminds me of, I mean, I think part of like, you know, we're talking about sort of like the internet and kind of navigating this space between, you know, what others you know, what you think you should think, or you know, what you think others think you should want, or what, you know, this sort of space between yourself and others. And Kierkegaard talks about how, like, in order to he has a short book called The Present Age, where he talks about kind of a lot of these forces. You know, he calls it the leveling mechanism, you know, which is that, like, things become sort of flattened and passionless and sort of like abstract, you know, that sort of like make people unable to act decisively or to want decisively, you know, and sort of like everything kind of becomes flattened into this like mush or of like sameness or something like that. But his sort of solution that he offers up is like what he calls like cultivating a sense of inwardness. And so I think, you know, when at least in my own experience, it's like when I'm online and I'm like, you know, constantly engaging with like all these different people and just seeing things flit across a screen, and I'm kind of like trapped in this kind of like indecisive mode, and maybe I should do this, but maybe I should do this. And the world is sort of like busted open as this kind of like crippling open-ended possibility or something like that. You know, something like prayer or meditation, or even just like reading with my, you know, phone and computer in the other room,
also action, right? Because, part of the point, and I think you write about this in your book, is what gets you out of this crippling introspection is that you act. And the character, on the one hand, he seems lost. There were some times when I was reading the book and I was like, man, this guy is so lost between screens and his thoughts and imagination. Like, where's reality? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he's married, so he did make some decisions. And he seems to, I think he was like a drug addict, so he got out of that. So in a way, the character's halfway there to being an actual person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, yeah, action is certainly one way of getting out of the muck of like of indecision, for sure. I mean, I wrote I wrote the novel in a sort of like in between space in my life where, like, you know, I was in a long-term relationship. I wasn't married yet, you know, but I had sort of started thinking seriously about kind of like, you know, spiritual or religious things, but I hadn't yet become sort of made any sorts of like decisions in that way. Yeah, in some ways, the novel is about that kind of like in between space of like attempting to emerge from the kind of like indecisive, sort of like not wanting enough kind of like mode that Shadi's talking about, and trying to like emerge into something else, you know, or step forward into something else.
So this is my theory about the end of the novel, because we're making it sound like the character is very like lost and depressed and distracted and angry, like many people on the internet, but. I thought the ending of the novel, I was inspired. I was like, nihilistic ending. This is not.
Wait, Santi, are we allowed to say what happens at the end? Because we don't want to give away the ending.
I mean, it's not really like a plot book. And it's not like one of these books.
Who killed the novelist? I'm going to reveal it now.
And then there's a murder, and does he get away with it or not? You know,
it was Harold Bloom.
Right. No, yes, just exactly. Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Just kidding. So I'm going to say two names that you reminded me of, Jordan, in those last few pages. The first is Plato, and the second is Dante.
Dude, you should have said that you should have said that right at the beginning. Dude. No,
so first of all, he's in a dark wood. That's the beginning of the Divine Comedy, and it's a middle-aged man in the Divine Comedy, 35, which may be 40 today, and he's like, I need to find a new meaning in my life, and the guy's in a dark wood, and maybe it's a darkening wood with a dog. So the dog is Virgil. No, I mean, that I just made that up. Then the other
back
thing...
Back then, life expectancy was a lot. I mean, so it's not even like 40 is the new 35. It's like, life expectancy was probably, what, like 50, 55 or something?
Yeah, probably.
So that's like 35 is late in the game.
Yeah. Well, similar situation then. But yeah. And then Plato, because
this comparison, all right?
the last part, and I have to say this, like, I turned around And I was like, that filled me with tremendous frisson, to use the French term, the technical term, because Plato in the Republic, when he's talking about the cave and leaving the cave and seeing the truth, he explains what education is. It's leaving the cave, but he defines it this way. It's the art of turning around. So you become free and you turn to the truth when you turn around. So I was like, shit, he's working on all these levels.
Wow. Say more about that. That's kind of nice.
So like turning around is metaphorical here, right? You're radically changing the direction of your life from one that is, according to Plato, like stuck in images. You're in the cave. You're looking at things that aren't reality. You're commenting on images. One of the nice details of Plato's analogy of the cave is that within the cave, people give each other awards for being the best at interpreting the images on the back of the wall.
Mm.
So commenting on things that aren't real. And to be educated means to break free of all that and to turn around. Mm. And he's like, a teacher has to teach the art of turning around. So the art of pointing people in the right direction and freeing them of you know, BS. And it seemed like the same thing happened with the character in the novelist, because he's like, the whole day he's sort of chained to his computer, to flittering images. He's not even totally conscious when he logs onto Twitter, when he logs off to Twitter. He's also kind of at the mercy of his own emotion, because his hatred of Eric. I really love the part of Facebook where he's looking at pictures of one of his high school friends or something, and he's like getting really angry at he turns away from all that, and he finds, and I think that the novel ends with a hint that there's going to be a new life and there's going to be like fruit at the end of his struggle. So.
Nice. Thank you for that. That's
all you can say. Like, I like literally wrote in my notebook about this, where I write about every book I read. I'm like, damn, Jordan Castro, this is.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. That sounds great. You know,
that's amazing.
You know, I mean, I will say that when I wrote the last line, I just knew it was the last line. Sort of in this like intuitive, visceral way, I was like, "Well, that's the last line." And the whole novel wasn't even done yet, and I was just like, "All right, I know that's the last line."
Mm. Well, the other thing that Plato says is that poets are possessed by demons and they don't know what they're doing. So
that's probably you know, hopefully not. You know, well, I'm a novelist, so you know, what does he say about that? You know, but yeah, I mean, I certainly felt like it was a hopeful than a not terribly hopeful ending, but you know, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of midlife crises and the 35, 40 thing, you know, let's kind of dwell on that for a moment, because, you know, as Santi sort of teased, you are, I think, one of the few openly religious novelists, at least of those that I follow. And I don't know how well known it is, but you're a Christian convert.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume that's public in some fashion. Mm-hmm. Not that it's anything that you would like necessarily need to hide, but it's interesting that we even talk about it like this, that, oh my God, mm-hmm. you came out as Christian. Like, right. What happens if people find out about that? Which just goes to show that the kind of literary scene is obviously seen, like, that's not necessarily where you see a lot of like outwardly observant or religious Christians. So that's really, so clearly you went through major changes. I mean, you end up getting married, you moved out to the countryside. You seem to be praying more based on what you just said. And now you're Christian. Maybe just tell us a little bit and about that and how that relates to the character in the novel. I mean, is the narrator in the novel also a Christian convert? How does he have an interior life where he thinks about religion? And I guess I'm also curious, like, do you see the narrator of your own novel? Is he someone that you know? Like, is he someone that you have a relationship with? Is he a friend? Is he a version of yourself? Like, what's your own relationship to the character? I know there's a lot there, but yeah.
I mean, I think I've sometimes described the novelist as like, or the narrator of the, I've described it as almost like a pre-Christian novel or something like that. You know, I don't think that the guy is like a Christian or something like that, but is, like I said, it's kind of like in this space between sort of like whatever, like the screen and his life, or sort of like, you know, his old life and a new life, or kind of like in this, you know, sort of making these various attempts to emerge from whether it's like his past or the sort of tortured present into something sort of new and life-giving, and kind of like, and I think, you know, personally, that process was not, in my own life, it was not like, you know, how some people describe having this sort of like overwhelming white light experience, or this kind of like revelation that kind of like hits them and they know, you know? I mean, for me, my life has been kind of like a long series of sort of like, you know, maybe it's been to some extent, like, I mean, in some ways it's definitely been a kind of like progression in certain ways, you know. I mean, I used to be like, you know, addicted to heroin and selling drugs and all this stuff.
Oh, so, wait, that's, I wasn't sure about that. So the narrator is an addict. I wasn't sure if that part extended to your own life as well.
Yeah. But so in some ways, you know, my life is sort of, I've had this sort of like progression away from certain proclivities and behaviors and stuff and internal states or whatever. But in another way, it hasn't been like exact, it wasn't just like a boom, everything's better now, you know, like a lot of the time things are sort of portrayed that way. It's sort of like, you know, many stops and starts and sorts of like, I feel like William James in The Varieties of Religious Experience talks about the religious experience of what he calls the educational variety, you know, where it's sort of this gradual sort of like learning and like process or something. And for me, that's very much what it looked like, you know. I think the novel sort of like renders, I guess just like a morning in the life of someone who is kind of like on a certain path or something. And my relationship to that is sort of, it's like a version of me, also maybe a friend. Also at some point, I think in the process of working on the novel over years, you know, in some very like literal sense, there's like words on a page that I'm like, you know, editing to make sure that they, you know, that the sentences are like, it's weird. Like, it's like, on the one hand, it's like a living character in this book. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, I'm making all these like editorial decisions so that the novel is like propulsive and like fun to read and like, you know, dynamic, and all these different stylistic choices that like, that also factor in. And so it's like this kind of like, so it's sort of like a both and. Yeah.
And how do people, I mean, how did you choose Christianity in particular? Like,
it's a hard question. I mean, in some ways it was, it felt, you know, I in some ways I feel like I guess I chose it. In other ways, I feel like it
chose you.
I mean, it's such a like a weird, it sounds like mystification to say that, you know what I mean? It sounds like, it sounds just like I'm just like a load of crap, or, you know, you hear people talk like that and it's just like, well, what could that even possibly mean? You know? You know, and then of course, like, it's like, I feel like I'm trying to like interpret, you know, my own life in retrospect, which is also kind of a fraught endeavor or whatever. But you know, I mean, one thing was that my now wife, right before we started dating, she had like a sort of like profound experience where she like went to church with her mom and sort of like had this like experience. It sounds like something you would read from, you know, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, where it was like, she just knew that she was having an experience of God's love, you know? And I, at the time, had sort of like all of the characteristic intellectual and contemporary like gripes with Christianity. I thought that it was like stupid and kind of dumb. And I kind of just like associated it with like, you know, whatever, people like George Bush or something, you know. I just had no kind of like frame for understanding it. And I kind of thought it was maybe for her like a phase or something like that. And then when I realized that it wasn't, it was sort of becoming this like tension point in our relationship. And so like, I sort of started reading about it and learning about it, not as a way to like disprove her exactly, but like certainly with like the most, certainly an uncharitable spirit, you know what I mean? Like just kind of like, well, let me try and understand it, you know, cause she didn't really have a language for articulating it, you know? And so, but the more I read and the more Christians that I met, especially like younger Christians and, you know, people, we lived in Maryland for a while. So we made some friends with people who were like at the Catholic University there. And then also her mother's experience, hearing her mother's, her parents are from former Czechoslovakia. And so they grew up under communism and this kind of thing. And like her experience of Christianity was like the polar opposite of this kind of like straw man that I had in my head, where she was sort of like, it was punk basically. They were meeting in basements and, you know, transcribing the Bible because it was sort of this like illicit type of thing or whatever. And seeing this sort of like living and active faith that was able to like withstand very difficult circumstances and seeing sort of like the power of, you know, it's weird because as an intellectual as someone who likes to read and think and so on, you know, in some ways reading the sort of Christian, you know, reading theologians and philosophers and these kinds of things and talking, in some ways that helped me a lot. But in other ways, sort of seeing my wife and her mother's like faith in terms of like, you know, seeing sort of, for example, like transcendent sort of like forgiveness just like manifest in their life in a way that was like, you know, that like, you know, it's sort of hard to explain and kind of just like bizarre or other kinds of things was more affecting to me over time, even though I was sort of like resistant to it and even resentful of it. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. That's sort of like a long way of saying it. Christianity specifically. I mean, I had read when I was much younger, sort of like a lot of different Eastern type of things, and that kind of didn't really hold for me or whatever. And then there was, of course, just the person of Jesus, and like reading Gerard, reading other things that where it felt like I just sort of felt at some point unable to unsee certain things that I was seeing or and it maps so harmoniously onto my own sorts of like experiences in life. But it really, when I say it felt like it happened to me, I guess part of what I mean is like, I really did not want to become Christian. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was like, this is stupid and cringe and dumb and whatever. And what are people going to think? And, you know, like, and whatever. And so, yeah, and despite all that, here I am, you know.
No, that's a wonderful answer. I mean, thanks for sharing that. But I guess that raises the question: what do people think? Like, because it sounds like you were concerned about that, how it might appear.
Mm-hmm. And what's weird is that I thought, okay, I'm going to become a Christian, and my literary life is going to be over, and like my, you know, any sort of like clout or whatever you want to, not clout exactly, you know, any sort of like, I'm just like, it's over, you know what I mean? And I have no idea what my life will look like now. And that is part of, and that was part of like this, the fear or the whatever. And things have just been kind of great. Like, I mean, I'm sure there are people that think it's dumb or whatever, but I've met so many like, smart and interesting, Christians, and my life has been made so much richer for it. And like, my writing has gotten better and like, I've been getting more success. And so I'm not to say like that they're perfectly correlated or something, but like my fears related to it seem to have not come true. And if anybody is like sort of, you know, hating, they're doing it in a way that I can't see, you know? So I don't know. Also what it should, doesn't matter either way, I guess, ultimately, but I've been like weirdly surprised and delighted to find that things have, it hasn't had the sort of negative reputational effect or something that I've thought.
And maybe just like one final thing on this thread, you know, since you are increasingly public and getting more, I don't know if fame is the right word. Notoriety could be another word. I don't know, whatever
fame
it might
works,
be.
Man. Fame works, no,
yeah.
Yeah.
Attention.
Yeah.
But like, do you think a lot about how other people, like, maybe not like super consciously, but I'm sure it's something that occurs to you on a somewhat regular basis. And you do care about your literary reputation. So do you think a lot about how people see you and how they perceive you? And like, how much are you trying to like, because you are part of a scene, whether you like it or not. I mean, you're saying, you know, you want to remove yourself from some of those dynamics, but ultimately you're part of a broader like social group of literary people, writers, novelists, and so forth. You know, do you think about how people view you? And, you know, how do people see you? Like, how do people look at the new Jordan, the Jordan who is like ascendant in the literary scene? Have people changed their behavior towards you as a result of your kind of growing like fame or semi-fame?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, one of the weird things are, so before I haven't talked about this, but so before the novel came out, I was praying like every day because I was noticing in myself like a fear of what other people would think of me. And it was like torturous, you know what I mean? It was like, it was pathetic, and it's sort of like, it's like, dude, what the heck, you know, like you like to think, I like to think of myself as someone who's sort of like above all that, you know, like I don't care what it is, you know, but I kept noticing it in myself. And so I would pray, you know, that God would help me to care more what he thinks about me than what other people think of me. And I would even sort of like frame it in terms of like repent, you know, I'd be like, look, I care more what other people think of me than what you think of me. Like, please like sort of correct this in me. And I think that had like a profound effect on me, where like, it's not to say that I don't care what other people think of me, but I think like, you know, a lot of the time I think people think of the fear of God as some sort of like oppressive kind of tyrannical thing. But I think in reality, it protects against the fear of other people, which is much more oppressive. You know, like when people are operating from this weak place of caring what other people think about them and operating in that way, it's really fear-based action and speech and so on. And I feel like, I mean, on a day to day basis, obviously, but like, and I'm not, but I feel like I've been freed to some extent of that, certainly the worst excesses of it through like my faith and stuff like that. And so like, I really do try as best that I can, and I'm not like perfect at it, but like, I try and like, you know, think more about what's true or what's good or what is sort of like, or something like that, than like what others are going to like. And, again, like I'm not always like acting in that way, you know, but it's certainly like my ideal that I strive for. And I've noticed that like, it seems like good results. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say how people treat, I don't know that people, like, because my life is so, you know, I live with my wife, we have some friends and stuff like that. But I'm not like, always like out and about like seeing, you know, whatever. So it's sort of like, I don't know how people like see me, I guess. I just don't know. And I try not to actually like, I can't control it. And I try not to control it. And I try not to think about it.
There's this quote that I always think about when people talk about this, from this Argentinian writer, Ernesto Sabato. And he says, to not care what critics think, you require thick skin. But what characterizes a writer is that he has extreme sensitivity of skin, because you have to be sensitive to the world and describe it and get to know it.
Right. Well, and I read Alex Perez's review of my novel, but I didn't read any of the reviews. And like, and I also like, you were going to talk about the Goodreads stuff. Like, I haven't read them. I one time scrolled through them quickly to try and find funny negative ones to like post. But
has Nicolette read them? Your wife?
I think she's read some of the reviews, and my publisher would send me like, they would send me quotes. They would like a good quote from a review, so I could like tweet it and link it, you know? And so I could like, I had some sense they were like good, you know? But that's part of the reason why I didn't read them, and is because like, you know, yeah, right. You'd have to have, it's like, if they're bad, you know, I'm probably too sensitive for that. But even if they're good, like, you don't want to get puffed up and like believe that either. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, and so I really truly do everything I can. And it's not because I think like, oh, they're not, it's just, I just try and insulate. I don't think I'm like above those dynamics to where like, it's like, you know, I could read them and just like not care. You know what I mean? Like I just don't read them.
But aren't you curious just to see how other people like react? I mean, cause it's sort of like your baby. It's something that's very dear to you, and to see people engaging with it in public, whether it's good or bad, putting that aside, they have a reaction to your art, if you will. And don't you want to see, like, isn't it tempting to kind of see how people are interacting with the art? Like, so if you're a painter, I presume at a gallery showing, you want to see people like, oh, like you're curious, like, are they moved by the paintings they're seeing? Are they kind of like standing in front of one painting for like 10 minutes because they're just like really engaged with it? You must have a lot of self-discipline, I guess.
The thing. Like, I don't know if it's self-discipline more than just like, I just don't want that in my like head. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's like, I just don't. And, you know, and I mean, I get some sense. I mean, like, you know, Santi just, you know, comparing the ending to Plato and stuff is really like gratifying and nice, you know? And like, I appreciate that. And people like,
I'll tweet it later.
You should do that. That'd be great. People like come up, this is kind of like, you know, people like come up to, it's like nice. And people show up to readings and say nice things. And like, it's definitely gratifying, but at the same time, I think part of it is like, I'm just very suspicious of, in part, like we're talking about these scene dynamics. We're talking about all these different kinds of things. It's like, people have all kinds of, you know, it's just none of my business almost, you know? I mean, like what people, it's my job to kind of like write the books that I, you know, to write to the best of my ability, the books that I want to write or want to read. And you know, and I think I have some sense of like when that's, you know, when I'm writing and working with an editor, I have some sense of when that's working and how it's working or whatever. And so it's like my job to just do the best that I can do. And then like the rest is just kind of like up to other people. And like, I want to sell books for like crudely sort of like, so that I can keep writing them and stuff. But, and I'm grateful when people have certain reactions or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. I just don't want to,
so,
I don't.
Yeah. So you don't care about like,
I mean, it might be that I care too much, right?
Like
if I read something, you know, and the person is like misinterpret, you know, it just would drive me crazy, I think, you know what I mean? And so I just kind of stay away from it, you know? And I would have liked to have, well, I just watched my words, but it could have, the book probably would have sold more if there was more negative reviews. You know what I mean? It seemed like there were a lot of positive ones, and like, you know, people were preparing me for it to be polarized. I'm sure in Goodreads it's polarizing, or and I've seen tweets, people have like had really funny mean tweets at me and stuff like that. But like, but yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it could have
You wanted more negative reviews. Well, I hadn't thought about it like that. That's interesting that can actually drive interest.
I can also do that for you. Shadi, you've also published books, though. I'm curious, what has been your policy about reading reviews? Shadi, because you have three books, right? Two books.
I'm not going to pretend that I don't read the reviews. I read the reviews.
But they were nonfiction, right?
But sorry?
Your books are nonfiction?
Yep. If they were fiction, you probably would have heard of me, right? You'd be like, oh man, Shadi's a novelist. He wrote a novel.
But with nonfiction, it's a little different, right? Because people are like engaging with your, like, would it be different? I don't know.
I think it's different in a way that I'm actually sharing ideas that, like, I want to change things. There's a more practical element that you're arguing, you're making certain arguments about certain ideas, and sometimes it's about like specific aspects of US foreign policy that you want the US to do something different in X conflict or with X country. So you want to see if people are they responding to that? Are they getting the message? Are they pushing back? Because you also, based on what you see in the reviews, that can also like affect how you fine tune some of your arguments, because there is an element of persuasion where, like, as far as I can tell in novels, like, you're not trying to really there's not like a persuasion element in the same way. It's more like, here's a piece of art. Here's something that's really dear to me. I want you to read it. But in the end, like, it's your art. So you don't, it's not like you're going to fine tune based on people telling you to write it differently. Or maybe some novelists do that. They're very sensitive to critiques, and maybe that will affect how they write future novels. And that's probably not healthy. Like, you don't want to be too affected by that. But I think for us as nonfiction writers, there's more of that, like, direct engagement with the audience, of persuasion, right, of getting into debates about the specific arguments that you're making in the book. That's my sense, but I could, Santi, does that sound right to you? I mean,
yeah, I mean, because when you write something, a political book, as you do, Shadi, you're engaging in a debate, right?
Yeah.
So you want the feedback, and you want people to argue with you, because that's the point of the book. And you want the debate to advance in some way.
Yes.
Well, Jordan, he crafts a work of art, and he sends it out, and he wants people to engage with it, experience it. But there's nothing more for him to do.
Well, and right? It's also one of these weird things where it's like, I would love for other people to argue about it or whatever, you know? But, like, I mean, as you could probably tell from this conversation, I'm not necessarily the best interpreter of my own work either. You know what I mean? I'm not the best at, like, talking about it.
Yeah, you,
like,
totally missed the Plato angle. Yeah.
I missed it. Yeah. You know, or whatever. And, you know, and so you know, I'm not the biggest Hemingway fan or whatever, but he has this, like, this quip where, like, they were asking about, like, the sort of symbolism in the old man and the sea or whatever. And he's just like, what symbolism? Like, I'll just, like, leave that to the explainers, you know? He called them the explainers. He's like, you know, that's the job of the explainers. And in some ways, I think, like, it is just the job of other people to kind of, like, do the discourse or whatever about it. And, like, and the other weird thing about, like, fiction, there's a strange, like, I think maybe it's part of MFA culture or something, like, which, you know, I've never taken like a writing workshop or whatever. But this idea that, like, you should just take feedback from any random person. It's like, I only want feedback from people who are, like, better writers than me, people who I respect, or my editor. Like, I don't want just random people just telling me what they think about my, it's like you can learn from people who you want to learn from. Like, why, what does it matter? Like, what, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Unless it's a writer that I like, that I think they're a better writer than me, like, what am I going to, you know?
How many, but, like, let's be honest here, how many of those are there in the world? Like, I don't know, 7?
Yeah, I mean, if that, you know, I mean, there's a couple. No, there's quite a bit. I'm getting there. You know,
Welbeck, I mean, and...
I guess I can shout out Michael Kloon right now. I feel like big, you know.
Also, we should shout out to your wife, who has a novel. Exactly. She has a novel coming out soon, right?
Yeah, Nicolette is certainly a better writer than I am in a lot of ways.
Will this be her first novel?
It'll be her first novel. Yeah, she has a story collection. It's a Bitterwater opera. Nicolette Polak shouts out. It's like it's great.
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Well,
that's interesting. I mean, what do you think about, like, marrying someone who kind of is in the same field as you, who in a sense is, you know, this is a little bit of a tangent, but, you know, there is this debate about, like, compatibility where, you know, like, one where the idea of, like, a power couple, that you want someone who's sort of like, a professional or intellectual equal who's, like, engaging with you, and you guys are, like, a team, versus someone who's so, like, engrossed in their work that they actually want their partner to be in a different field. They could still be, like, your intellectual equal, but just in something completely different, because they're sort of like, it's too much of, like, the art and the writing and the kind of, like, two philosophers, just imagine them together. And, like, for people who have read
but, like,
it makes me think of the profile in the New Yorker about Agnes Callard, and she was not only was she married to one philosopher, she was married to basically two philosophers, and they lived together. It wasn't polyamorous. I mean, she wasn't married to them simultaneously, but even after she divorced one of them, they all still like lived together.
Yeah, I remember
that's like a lot of philosophy. Like you're doing that with your students, you're giving talks, and then you come back home and then you're engaging in more philosophical stuff with your partner and your ex.
It sounds like Santi's quote, the Flaubert quote about literature being one big orgy, is actually more true of philosophy. what you're saying.
But like, so how have you found that? Like, I guess you guys share each other's work. Or maybe you don't, because that might, because that can be taken really personally if you show some of your writing to your partner, and then she's like, "Oh man, hey, you're losing the magic, Jordan. Wow, this is," but she wants to be nice about it, so she's pulling her punches, and then this tension starts to build.
Yeah,
because you're not being honest with each other about the art, you know.
So yeah, I mean, I'm also reminded of that essay in The Cut that came out recently with Emily Gould, where she's talking about like all these resentments. I don't know if you guys read it, but all these resentments.
Yeah, we had an episode on it.
Okay. Yeah. You know, all these like you know, her marriage is some sort of competition where like, you know, her husband is more, you know, sort of like keeping score in terms of who's more successful or whatever. And you know, when me and Nicolette started dating, like we actually didn't know that we were each writers and or interested in writing. Like and we both were not successful. Like, you know, like we sort of like, I just don't think, I've never thought of it as a competition. I feel like her success is my success, and I think vice versa. And you know, I for a long time, you know, before I published novels and stuff, or this novel and now another, I was like an editor, and so it was like it was a little different. Where it was like I wasn't necessarily, what should I say? We show each other our work and we're honest with each other. You know what I mean? And like I tend not to show it in as early stages as she does. But I don't think it's ever been an issue of us being dishonest or of wanting to like please the other person in a certain way or work. She's very like thick skin and we just trust that the other wants the best for the other's work, you know? And so it's not like, it's really, but that being said, but she's also never been, you know, it's not like she's not like a fan. Like, I think she likes some of the things I've written and stuff like that, but she's not like a fan, you know, which I think is, and not that she's not a, I'm trying to say like, we're like equals, I guess, in that way.
She thinks you're decent, but not her fan.
No. I'm trying to like phrase it or see how, I think we respect each other's writing and we respect each other enough to let each other know when we think something's working or not. And we come from different, I mean, we sort of come from different traditions and so on. And so like, and so there's some differentiation there or whatever, but I think ultimately like, yeah, we're not competing. And I wouldn't even have occurred to me until I read that Emily Gould thing. I mean, the thought was so foreign and weird to me. And there were all these things she was referencing in there. Yeah. Like, you know, this person, these different, like, you know, female writers having these like weird competitive, I don't know. Yeah. Competitive relationships with their partners. I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah. So I haven't actually read that essay, although I have a general sense of what it's about. I wasn't, in that episode, but I do, maybe kind of brings us back to like the religious sensibility, because I feel like when I picture a couple being in competition with each other and those kinds of resentments building, I think about people who are like just very status oriented, who are more fearful of what others think than what God thinks, to bring it back to, I think, how you put it earlier, which I thought was really, really powerful. I mean, I feel like oftentimes I just fall back on this idea that like we sort of know the answer to the problems that we're facing of wanting and not wanting and desire and abundant choice and feeling like the world is being flattened before us. And I mean, you know, longtime listeners will know that religion is sort of like, it deals with a lot of these things. Like, you don't need to find necessarily another system. You can find like yoga, meditation, but the problem is they're all disjointed. It's not like an overall coherent systematic approach. So you still have to do a lot of choosing. If you're doing like, oh, meditation here, yoga here, my therapist here, this, that, and it doesn't give you the coherence that religion does, at least in theory. Obviously, there's a lot of religious people who are very spiteful and competitive in a way, and they like their marriages end because they're just concerned with small things.
But there's a sense though that if you share the same faith, you're in the same path, right?
You think it requires sharing the same faith?
Is that a question?
Yes, Santi. What?
You don't believe in interfaith marriage?
No, I do. I mean, if you fall in love, you fall in love. I have no rules about this. Might be complicated, but
yeah.
I'm Catholic. The Catholic Church lets you marry outside the faith. I think the stipulation, though, is that the kids have to be raised Catholic.
Similar to, Muslims, I guess, in that way.
Yeah.
It's a strange, there's all kinds of strange, this is like a total tangent, but there is strange stuff in the Bible, even about, if you're a believer and your spouse is not a believer, that they can somehow be sanctified by your own faith or belief, there's lines, and I can't remember what, in what book it's strange. There's also stuff about not being unequally yoked, which is sort of like the what people invoke to say that you shouldn't marry someone of different faith or whatever. I have no thoughts about that, but I or at least not any well formed enough to like make a proclamation.
I think the person with thoughts of marriage and love is shoddy, I think.
Well, you guys are both married, so I think you have I'm engaged. Experiential. Oh, is that not public?
No, it is. I'm engaged. Oh. I'm not married yet.
Oh, sorry. My bad. Yeah. Yeah. You're on the path. I'm on the path to greater things, God willing. I do think about it in the sense that if you have an absence of it in your own life, it almost makes it more present. So I have to reflect on it, I suppose, more than you guys do, because for you, it's just a reality of your lives and it sort of like folds into the everydayness of your existence, where it sort of stands out to me because it's something that I want and don't have.
That is one of the nice things because there is obviously a lot of thinking about it while you're dating, but then it's sort of two lives integrating with each other is peaceful. Yeah. Always peaceful, but brings peace.
One of the things about I think we started on this because we were talking about being two writers who are married or something. I really feel like the sort of having a faith in something bigger than yourselves, where like your success, my success as a writer is not sort of like my ultimate end, it's like it's sort of subordinate to sort of kind of like other concerns in my life. And so we're not like clawing tooth and nail, sort of like climb this ladder in the world that is like, in part due to our efforts, in part due to circumstance, it's like impossible to control or whatever.
And by the way, don't you think it also helps as an artist, excuse me, as an artist to not care about status?
Well, see,
one thing that strikes me is back to Flaubert, who keeps coming up. He was a genius writer. His best friend was Maxime Ducamp, who, have you heard of him? No, nobody's heard of him. But in his day, he had every possible honor that France could give a writer. Mm. And Flaubert was living with his mom and writing at night and tutoring during the day to make some money.
Mm-hmm.
But Flaubert is the one that ended up writing a few masterpieces.
Yeah, but he didn't know that they were masterpieces because he died before they were recognized in such a fashion. So does it really, like, does this kind of longevity and posterity matter so much when you're not actually alive to experience it? I mean, Maxime Ducamp was probably adulation maybe, but it's some people like that and enjoy that. So clearly he was getting a lot of that while he was alive, and Flaubert was like with his mom. So like, who's really
winning out
there?
There's a satisfaction in creating something beautiful. So I'm sure that when...
But did Flaubert know that it was beautiful until other people thought it was beautiful? that's the thing. We only think about his work as beautiful now in retrospect. But at the time, he probably was very despondent because, like, not only is my work not getting attention, but no one's it's hard to think that you've written a masterpiece if no one else thinks it's a masterpiece, right? That would be kind of self-important. Like, oh, I wrote a masterpiece.
But I think this is partly why, for me at least, I always tend to think that, like, and this is partly why I don't necessarily love talking about, like, my own writing or something, is because I think a novel, if you're a good writer, the novel should be smarter than you. And, like, you know, in some ways, it doesn't matter what Flaubert thought about its own writing. You know what I mean? In theory, the sort of like qualities that make it a masterpiece are within the text, you know, and, you know, maybe, and sort of revealed through the process of reading the text and so on. And like, you know, crowds, I mean, you know, crowd dynamics and, you know, who gets famous and all this type of stuff is very like fickle and based on all kinds of weird things. And like, for me, like, you know, it's thinking of it as being sort of like in service to the tradition of literature or to like beauty or to whatever these literary values or whatever. I would think that like it is more important to write a better than a worse novel or like or something like that. But then there are times like Dostoevsky was really sort of like famous in his day or whatever. And so I think. I mean, it's hard to say. Yeah, it's hard to say because sometimes that, yeah, it's hard. I'm not really.
Yeah. Okay. Well, another thought on this is because you said this is not really your ultimate desire in life, which is good. I mean, so you won't be sort of tied down to your, you know, rising or declining fortunes. I mean, hopefully they won't decline, but you know, at some point, like writers do have to contend with their subsequent novel not being as good as the one that came before. Like inevitably decline is something we encounter. It's just a question of when we encounter it.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, you know, as someone who has experienced a burst of success in a relatively short amount of time, would it really affect you? Like, let's say that, God forbid, your next novel, you know, doesn't do as well, or maybe like 10 years from now you experience like, you know, some form of writer's block, or you just decide that you don't really have another novel in you. Would that hurt you?
Yeah.
Like lack of success, like presumably you're not going to deal with that. Like that's not the easiest thing to deal with, no matter how sort of above it all you are or how close to God you are. Like we are human beings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm just curious, have you thought about like how you might deal with like the lack of success after having had success?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, trust me, I have another novel coming out. And I'm like, I'm well into a third, and you know, in the way that it works is like, unless there's an upward trajectory, right? Like unless the second novel does better than the first, it'll be very hard to sell the third for like, you know, a substantially greater sum of money than the second, you know? And that's like, and so like, but I mean, the way that who knows how I would deal with it, you know, if the second novel just tanks and just sucks and whatever. But I mean, ideally, I would just deal with it by working on another novel. You know what I mean? Like, I don't really know what else to do. Like, I like writing. I like the work. It really does feel like I just do love doing it. And it's all I like to do. It's all I feel like I'm like sort of uniquely qualified to do in many ways. And so like, I don't know what I would do then to just keep going. You know what I mean? And like, and I agree. I mean, I have this attitude where it's like, you know, most even great writers have like a few great books in them tops, you know? And so, I mean, you know, and so I'm not under like any illusion that like, that won't happen to me. It's more just like, I don't know. I mean, to be frank, my concerns are sort of more like practical of like, I just want to be able to make sort of like more money to like live off and do this. You know what I mean? Not like, not like, not like, just in terms of like outcomes that I would ideally want, you know, and like just because it's like it would, for me to be able
kid
to.
Kid needs soccer cleats, you know,
or whatever, you know, like.
So it's not about like making money. It's about like just being able to sustain, like to be able to like have a life that and do things that you want to do. Like it doesn't sound to me like you're someone who like cares about money a lot as like, oh, I need to be like rich.
No, I've never been motivated by it as an end. Exactly. I mean, I sort of have when I was like doing like drug dealing stuff when I was like, 8 years ago or whatever. I thought I was going to be like a
drug. You were like a proper like dealer.
Yeah. I was actually just telling this story to my priest for the first time last night. We were over at his house having dinner. I was like, I'm trying to think of how much it's okay. I mean, I ended up getting like, in trouble and so on, but
so you're
like,
clear with the law. We're not exposing.
I'm clear with the law, but yeah, I mean, we would have like, I'm not even sure what I got caught for, we'll say was like, like organizing like shipments to come in and then distributing them and stuff. And
whoa,
stuff.
You organize shipments? That's like,
just it was weed. It was only weed at the time when weed was illegal. And yeah, I sort of like happened into it and so but then I was motivated by money. Yeah, I was but I told myself even then that I was doing it so that I would have time to write. But then I didn't write it all. I just didn't write it all. And I was like, I became weirdly obsessed with like fashion. I was spending all this money on like clothes and like and just spending crazy money and making crazy money. And then it ended in this sort of like, horrible. I lost a bunch of money and things that didn't work out in the end. But
wow.
Because I don't get you really have a story there, man.
Yeah. A memoir.
Raise yourself out of a pit.
Yeah.
I don't get that vibe from you at all, though. Like, I don't get like a drug organizing, like shipment. Like, that's like, wow. You don't.
Dude, I got out of it before this time, but the way that it ended for my friends was that the police busted into their house, took like 150 pounds of weed, a bunch of cash, and then they never charged them with it. I think the police just stole it. That's like how the whole thing like ended. It was like police just, it was like everyone was just sick thinking they were going to go to prison for a long time, and then nothing happened. Whoa. This was like eight years ago or something like that. It was like,
wow, that's pretty cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Glad to hear. I mean, and maybe just as we close up here, I don't want to leave without us. Like, can you make, I mean, to the extent that you're comfortable, I'm surprised. I guess I just didn't make the connection that the narrator was you insofar as it related to heroin addiction. And that's probably just because I just don't know many heroin addicts. It feels very like foreign to me. Like, oh my God, a heroin addict.
Yeah.
Like a successful novelist probably didn't do that, you know, because it's, you know, it's hard to go from heroin addict to like successful novelist. Although of course there is a tradition of that, I suppose. But what is it like? I mean, what is it like to be a heroin addict?
While you're using it, or while you're, or to be off of it.
I mean, maybe both. I'm curious. Well, maybe just to start with, like actually being an addict and having that consume your life.
Yeah.
And because my understanding is that, like, that's you're always. Okay, I'm gonna sound like very nice, like not like drug like aware or whatever, but like you're always looking for the next hit. Yeah. You know? Oh my God! You're always trying to like,
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, it's literally like one of the worst, you know, one of the weird things about, I mean, yeah, I mean, it was horrible. You know, I couldn't keep a job. I was like working these different shitty jobs. Like, you know, I worked at a factory at one point and I got in trouble because I would just like sit on the floor in this, you know, people would come by and just like yell at me and shit. I couldn't even like, my job was to like fold boxes and stack the boxes, you know, and I like couldn't even do that, you know.
Because were high or because you were like.
Either, you know, I was either always high or always sick, you know. And I couldn't, you know, some junkies are really sort of like, they're able to concoct these schemes and kind of like get enough money to get right and stuff. I was never really able to do that. It was always very pathetic. And so like, you know, I would be stealing, you know, money from friends or, you know, like just getting into debt with my dealer or whatever. It was just like, it was really just kind of miserable, you know. And like I overdosed a couple of times.
Oh my God.
You know, one overdose was like real. And then I ended up, in the hospital, this kind of thing. So it's like really miserable, you know? And I think like, but one of the weird things about it is that, and what my friend, Michael Kloon talks about this is that, and this is partly what I think about in terms of autofiction around writing. He says that with drug addiction, it's strange because when you're an addict, you're the last person that has perspective on your own life. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you're an addict and you have all these just completely delusional ideas about what you're going to do and what you're like as a person and, you know, all this stuff. And in reality, your days are just spent just kind of like copping and getting high and then, and, you know, stealing maybe and like, and then repeat or whatever. And you know, so with writing too, like it's kind of like, I'm kind of interested in the way that like, yeah, like experience like turns into knowledge, you know what I'm saying? Because it's not like a straight line and whatever. But so yeah, I mean, being a heroin addict just sucks. And it is rare. I mean, the weird thing about it, it's rare to get clean. I mean, most people when they get, I mean, I'm sort of a classic example of like, I grew up in Cleveland, or a suburb of Cleveland, and like everyone was just on pills, like tons of people were just on pills, you know, opiate sort of like epidemic kind of went through there crazy. And I thought that like everyone, like sort of my age was just like doing pills. And cause where I was, that was just true. And then like when I moved, I realized like, oh, there's not just heroin addicts or ex-heroin addicts like everywhere, you know? But like where I grew up, that really was the case. I mean, people were getting, and it, like all different kinds.
Kurt Cobain wasn't a cautionary tale.
I was too punk even for Nirvana when I was growing up. I was but yeah, I don't know.
Is that,
I
mean, how you got like hooked on it? Is because a lot of other people were doing it around you. It was just like the mood music of your environment.
It's hard to say, you know, I mean, I just started, you know, I can't remember the first time I did it, but I, you know, well, heroin, it was weird. I mean, I first got addicted to opiate pills, you know, like Percocet and Vicodin and stuff like that.
Because you had like, because you got hurt or you were just taking it recreationally?
No, I was just taking it recreationally, you know, but I mean, I certainly didn't have a sense that it was like that bad or whatever. And then, yeah, before I knew it, I was addicted. And I'd gone to rehab before I even did heroin. I actually learned how to shoot heroin with a guy that I met in rehab, you know, which is sort of like another strange, whatever. This is like another tangent, but it's like this weird thing of like, part of the strange thing about like heroin addiction as like a, you know, or opiate addiction as like an epidemic is that like, it is a sort of like social problem, obviously. But the weird thing about it is that like treatment centers and all these different recovery, they have like abysmal like rates of success, you know?
Huh.
And so, yeah. So anyway, I don't know. It's, but yeah.
When in the novel, when the character rants against drug memoirs,
yeah,
does that reflect your own views? Is there actually a good drug memoir?
I mean, I keep shouting him out, but Michael Kloon wrote a novel or a memoir called White Out. Michael Kloon's like an academic at Case Western in Cleveland, but McNally Editions in New York actually just released this memoir called White Out, and it's absolutely incredible. And so,
wow, I think
that is the best.
Okay,
the best drug.
But why don't you think they work generally?
I think exactly because of what I was talking about, where like a lot of the time, addicts are uniquely blind to their own selves and their own predicament, you know, and so like, and they're masters at self-justification, you know, and masters at self-delusion, you know. It's sort of this like mechanism that grows in you when you're an addict. You know, you're always justifying just the most abject behavior and frames of mind and, you know, self-centeredness and so on. And so you learn in some ways to like just be delusional. And I think sometimes that carries into like drug writing, you know, where it's like, I don't know.
You have to be true to yourself to be a good writer, and you can't do that when you're hooked.
Right. Mm. Or either that or, you know, you recover. And even then it's hard to interpret your own experience in a way that's like truthful or interesting. You know what I mean? Even if it is truthful, it's like often not very interesting or kind of hokey or something. It's hard to, yeah, it's hard to kind of.
And like knowing yourself is hard, not bullshitting yourself. I mean, confessional writing has to be hard, I assume. Like we just remember the successes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that true though? That I feel like a lot of people dwell on the negative, like the negative in a sense almost like sticks out more in the memory because it's just like, people also like to be sad. Like there is something in our culture where emphasizing aspects of like despondency or sadness or, they're putting pressure on you at the library.
There's some people out the
okay.
Just staring at
they like wait, they booked your room.
I think they did, yeah.
Yeah.
You got this room?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I'll be out in 1 second.
That's amazing. Thanks. Well, that is a great note upon which to end. The novelist is in a library and he just got interrupted by an incoming group because they need the room.
Little do they know
who they want. Like, you should be like, I'm Jordan Castro, the novelist.
I'm on a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know who I am? I'm Jordan Castro.
Go to C in the fiction section.
Okay, but so before we leave, though, just say one hopeful word for any of our listeners that might be hooked on drugs or tempted by drugs, because I was kind of bleak.
Oh, there's a solution. You don't have to live this way anymore. There's all kinds of resources. You know, just because the statistics are bad doesn't mean that you can't get clean. I got clean. I know a million people that got off it. Get help. You know what I mean? There's 12-step programs, there's treatment centers, you know, but get help from someone else. You know what I mean? You can't do it alone. And so then, but it's possible. I mean, it's certainly,
living proof right here. Look, I mean,
I'm a famous novelist. there's hope. Okay. I'm not just Dante, Plato, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I can just take it from them. I'm not even the one saying it. Just take it from them. But you can get on heroin and you can become a, now these people.
okay. Right. Jordan, this is awesome. Thanks so much. It was a real pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Yeah. A lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Wait.